Let's play some cards.
From Harrah's St. Louis Casino and Hotel, this is The Final Table, starring professional poker player Dennis Phillips and Paul Harrah's.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner!
Wow, winning.
Now, from the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com.
Welcome to 2012 and our show number 152. I am Paul Harrah, sitting in the World Series of Poker Room at Harrah's St. Louis. My partner Dennis Phillips is at home in Las Vegas. Hi, Dennis. Happy New Year.
You 152. Who would have ever thought it?
Yep. We're approaching our three-year anniversary in just a few weeks, but here we are rolling into the new year, and I know over the holidays I was doing a lot of stuff with family and only got to play a couple of live cash game sessions, one winner, one loser, ended up pretty much pushing for the holidays. What have you been up to?
Actually, been relaxing a little bit. Didn't do a whole lot of partying over the weekend with New Year's Eve. Just kind of enjoyed out here. They had eight different casinos that had fireworks going on, pretty good display everywhere, a lot of stuff going on at Fremont Street, and the usual 314,000, I think, is what they had down on the strip. Just a couple of people showed up.
Wow.
And then played a couple of small tournaments, kind of getting ready for the PCA. I head for the PCA on Thursday, and just ran around here playing a couple of small tournaments at some of the venues out here and was pleasantly surprised by a couple of them. Did you hear there's news going on at the Tropicana?
I know that Tropicana has changed their poker room. You told us about some changes they made there last year. And I know just a few weeks ago, they made a deal where it's now called the Jamie Gold Poker Room, right?
It is. Jamie texted me a couple of days ago and said he was kind of throwing together a Welcome to Vegas tournament. And asked if I could run down there, and I said, sure, I'd be down there. So I showed up down there. Of course, then Jamie put a bounty on my head. but to be truthful, he put a bounty on his own head, too, so that wasn't too bad. But we did. We had fun. It's a small room right now, but I've got some interesting things, some developments coming. Right now, there's only about 8 or 10 tables in that room, but they're actually under construction right now to expand that, and I think they're going to quadruple the room.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's the Tropicana is going to become a major player in poker in Vegas. They're tying up with some Canadian poker leagues to send some people down here. They're going to hold some tournaments down here. Schedule isn't out yet. They're hoping for the grand opening in about a month or so. Jamie's invited a mess of people. He invited me back to it, which I hopefully I'll be able to go. We'll see when we get the date. It's kind of a hectic next couple of months.
Yeah.
But should be interesting. And this is so cool. One of the things that Jamie's going to do is he's going to promote talking at the table instead of prohibiting talking at the table.
Well, of course, it's the Jamie Gold Poker Room. You have to have talking at the table.
I think we need to have Jamie on here and let him do a little talking and tell us exactly what plans they are. We ought to plan on having him in there in the next couple of weeks. What do you think?
I think, you know, we kind of shorted him a few weeks ago when he was on and he was doing something out there, and we only had like 4 or 5 minutes with him. I'd love to have him back and talk about that, particularly because I think that the pendulum has swung way too far the other way when it comes to talking at the table. Far too often, I find in tournaments and also in some cash games, you're sitting in pretty much a talk-free environment at all times. Even people who aren't involved in hands or between hands, there's not a lot of talking going on. I think that we're missing out on some of the social aspect of the game, not necessarily the psychological aspect that Jamie plays, but the social aspect of poker. You know, that goes away, and I think you hurt the game.
I agree with you. I think they've gone way too far, but I will give a little bit of credence. One of the reasons why they try to monitor or, you know, control the talking at the table, you want people to have fun there. The average guy that's going in there and playing in a 1-3 or a $50 tournament or something, he's going there to have fun, to enjoy it, and he doesn't want to be ridiculed by other players. He doesn't want to be, you know, embarrassed at the table. And that happens some. You've seen it. So, you know, maybe the reason why they tried to do that was not so much to, you know, control the edge that a pro may have by talking about it. But maybe they're trying to make it a better playing environment. I think the talking at the table is part of the environment. It's part of the fun. The social interaction is enjoyable. So I kind of lean toward Jamie on this one, to be honest.
Yeah, I do too, and I agree with you that there are different degrees of talk at the table. Anybody who's berating another player, first of all, that's just bad for your own poker game to tell another player that he's not doing the right thing. In the long run, you want him to continue to make mistakes without you giving him lessons at the table. Why? And I find a lot of young players in particular who haven't learned about live cash game poker as much as they should, I find them doing that quite often. And we've talked about instances that you and I have both run into in the past about that. But also, you know, that sort of thing being done by anybody, saying anything negative to other people at the table, that's out of line. But the kind of stuff where you're involved in a hand and you can't say anything about, you know, I wonder if my two pair is good here, trying to get a read off of somebody and that sort of thing, I don't think that detracts from the fun of the game. And if everybody at the table is just going to sit there silently and watch each other and watch the cards, yes, that has to be the way you play the game. But you're not sitting at home online silently. You're in a social environment surrounded by 10 other people. And you got to interact a little bit with them. Otherwise, it's boring.
I agree with you 100%. I sit down and play poker for fun. I enjoy it. I enjoy meeting new people. All aspects of life, all from all areas of the world. And it's just a blast. And I enjoy it. I enjoy the breaks. When we're sitting around talking and comparing notes, and some guy, I played down there at the Tropicana. A gentleman sitting next to me was from Italy and had a problem a little with the language, but wanted to talk to me. And it got to be hilarious. He was trying to talk to me, and I'm trying to understand it, and he's mispronouncing a word here and there, and then he laughed, and it was a blast. You know, so I love things like that.
Yeah, I think that there can be way too much intensity going on, and you're absolutely right, particularly with small buy-ins and small stakes.
Sure.
Recreational players are coming to have fun, and if that element isn't there, then that's no good for the game of poker.
It absolutely is. I want to springboard this thing because I can relate it to another situation. I played at the Orleans, which is, I think, only the second time I've ever played at that, last Friday. Last Friday, they had 300 people show up for a $100 tournament down there.
Wow.
No, and this is just their standard weekly tournament. It's just, you know, a ton of people, some of the biggest turnouts for low level that you can have. I had some fun there. Everybody from Karina Jett to Tom McAvoy, there was just a variety of different people down there, and we just had some fun. But I've got a hand to describe. And then I can comment about another gentleman who was not involved in the hand and how he tried to give lessons to it.
Okay.
So here it is very quickly. There was an obviously inexperienced player at the table in one of the blinds. He was an older gentleman who just hadn't obviously played a whole lot. Seemed like a nice guy. Gentleman under the gun raises. This is when it's 50 and 100 for blinds, and it's like the second level of the tournament. He makes it 300, folds all the way around to the gentleman in the small blind, who's extremely excited, and who raises it to 700. Everybody at the table knows he's not bluffing.
Yep.
I'm telling you, there are people in St. Louis that could probably hear him and know he's not bluffing.
Yep.
All right? No big deal, right? He raises it to 700. The guy across the table from me, who acted under the gun, thinks, goes into the tank. He's a pretty solid player. Just calls the 700. Flop comes out, ace-ace-5. Guy in the small blind shoves $12,000 into the pot.
Okay.
Guy across the table from me throws his hands up and goes, oh, my gosh, now what do I do?
Yeah.
Think back and forth. Oh, wow, you know, I don't know. This is ridiculous. He finally looks at him and says, I have no clue. I'm going to fold these. And turns over pocket kings.
Uh-huh.
All righty. The other guy smiles at him and turns over pocket aces.
Of course.
he flopped quads.
Yes.
And shoved.
Yep.
I'm enjoying this. This is fun. This is, you know, what the heck? We're all laughing about it. The guy that was sitting right next to the gentleman who had the king looks at me and rolls his eyes like I've never seen a roll before. But doesn't say anything. All right. Gentleman at the end of the table starts berating him and telling him how poor play it is and what were you afraid of and you shouldn't have played the hand this way. And the guy that rolled the eyes looks down at the table and says, "Sir, are you a teacher?" And just starts berating that player.
Yeah.
Oh, it was, I had a blast at that table. I ended up cashing, but it doesn't matter. It was just fun.
And you need some of that in the game. And by the way, kudos to the guy with pocket kings under the gun for realizing what was going on here, and he only lost 700 chips.
Oh, absolutely. He played it exactly. Now, he didn't know what was going on. Who in the right mind would think that the guy was going to shove there with a set of aces, much less quads? But, you know, ace, king, ace, queen. The guy just finally, he just, I don't know what I'm doing, so the heck with it, and turn those kings up, face up, and into the middle of the table.
I like
it. It was awesome.
This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show. He's Dennis Phillips in Las Vegas. I'm Paul Harris at the World Series of Poker Room at Harrah's St. Louis. We've got some news about this place to tell you a little bit later on. Also, we'll be joined in about 15 or 20 minutes by Tristan Wade, known online as Creative, who picked up his first bracelet at the WSOPE a couple of months ago and had a heck of a 2011. We'll talk to him. And he, by the way, is also a teacher with the Deep Stacks folks, who have a new tour that they're announcing for this year, which kicks off next month. So all of that coming up over the course of the rest of this hour. Now, there's a big news story that happened while we were away, because last week we re-ran the David Tuckman Bart Hansen Show, which is our most downloaded podcast ever. And thank you very much for those of you who subscribe via iTunes or are downloading us on whatever you use on an Android phone. I don't know what that software is. Or maybe you're just going and listening directly to the podcast on Dennis's website, thechipleader.com, under the Final Table Radio Show tab there. But while we were away, there was a big piece of news out of the Department of Justice, which, of course, was the bane of all online players back on April 15th, when the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, Parit Bharara, issued the indictments that led to what has become known as Black Friday and caused online poker to essentially leave the United States, at least online poker for money. There's still Zynga and there are still free money sites, but there has been question about when it can come back into the U.S. Well, just before Christmas, the Department of Justice issued a letter. They actually had come to the decision and issued the letter in September, but they released the letter just before Christmas. And essentially what it was a ruling on the Wire Act of 1961. It's a 50-year-old law that was passed by Congress in 1961 that essentially made all interstate use of telephone lines for gambling purposes illegal, and has been interpreted as being a way to keep online gaming, including online poker, illegal in the United States. Now, that's the interpretation of some. We've talked on this show about how we didn't think playing online poker was illegal, and the UIGEA indictments that the U.S. attorney handed down don't say that online poker is illegal. But there was a question that was raised by the states of New York and Illinois that had to do with online lotteries. And in reply to that, the Department of Justice issued a letter that said that the Wire Act didn't apply to lotteries, didn't apply to anything else except for sports betting. They didn't want bookies to be able to take bets over phone lines across state lines. And so what you've got there is a ruling that may be an opening for online poker. Now, Dennis, you've been following this a lot more closely than I have and probably know a little bit more about the intricacies of this, so I'll let you pick it up there.
Well, yeah, I don't even know where to start. You've covered the basics pretty well. The PPA has stated for years they didn't think the Wire Act applied. PokerStars and other of the major companies have stated for years they didn't think that the Wire Act applied. Basically, the federal government was trying to pull an action from 50 years ago when the Internet didn't exist and apply it to today's environment, which was ludicrous on the face of it. If they would do their own job and write current legislation for what's going on, rather than trying to pull some antiquated law up there and adapt it to present-day situations, then we wouldn't be faced with this thing. But irregardless, for years, since 06, since the UIGEA, there have been parties trying to get a ruling or an opinion from the DOJ concerning the Wire Act, concerning what you're getting it into an appellate court, getting it somewhere where a judge could actually look at it. Well, that's finally happened. It had to come through the lottery. It had to come through a couple of states, Illinois being the one. But they have actually now given their opinion, and their opinion agrees with what was stated years ago by the PPA and years ago by other companies, that the Wire Act does not apply, which means, as far as I'm concerned, my interpretation of it, and that poker playing online is legal. I think that's huge. Okay?
So what does this mean going forward for the possibility of actually getting us to the point where companies, whether it's out-of-the-country companies like PokerStars or in-the-country mm-hmm. companies like Caesars, the owner of Harrah's, which sponsors this show, or other companies who want to get involved in offering real money online poker?
Well, now, part of the problem that everybody had, be it on a state level or a federal level, is that if this action was illegal, they were going to have to amend or repeal the Wire Act, you know, by an act of Congress, then there was problems there, and it was a huge stumbling block. With the DOJ's opinion that the Wire Act does not apply, it opens up the gate for a state like Nevada to actually own, operate, and run an online poker site, in my opinion. And you are going to see, I believe, something happen within the next few months for online poker within the U.S.
In fact, while we were away in the last 2 weeks of December, didn't the Nevada legislature get together and come up with some regulations about what online poker would look like in terms of licensing in that state?
Yes, they absolutely did. In fact, they're even taking applications, and I believe they have four so far, four parties to actually provide online poker. And Nevada right now is in the forefront. There's several other states that are moving rapidly trying to do something, but they are in the forefront for permitting this for interstate and intrastate. Because if this does open it up and there's no problem with the Wire Act, there's no reason why you couldn't have a variety of states, just like they do in the lottery, just like they have for Powerball, come together and allow them to operate as a unit. Which means that if you live in New Jersey, you live in Florida, you live in Texas, you live in Nevada, as long as those states have a working agreement together, then you could play against each other rather than being restricted to within the borders of your own individual state.
Now, you mentioned other states. I know that there's a push on in New Jersey. A state senator there, Raymond Lesniak, is trying to get a bill through the legislature and onto Governor Christie's desk before their current session ends next Monday. They want to try to legalize interstate online gambling. The companies that run casinos in Atlantic City want to have all sorts of casino games online there, and that might be part of it. But Nevada also, New Jersey also has been fighting Nevada for a long time for gaming revenue, ever since Las Vegas and Atlantic City were the only places you could gamble legally in the United States.
Yep.
Now those two states want to turn it into the only two states where you can have online gambling. But my question about both those states and every one of the other 48 is, what about the UIGEA? Isn't that still in the way, Dennis?
Okay, the UIGEA basically was just concerned with the banking into it, with the transfer of funds. But it brings up so many more questions right now. I'm going to go off on a little bit of a tangent here and talk about three or four different areas of it. If online poker was never illegal, if the Wire Act never applied to it, if there was nothing wrong with it, then what is the position of the UIGEA? This may not be a good example, but I'm going to try it. If somebody wants to rip me apart for it, go ahead. Say you're on trial for something, and you commit perjury. But then you're acquitted and found that you're innocent of all the charges. Does the perjury charge stand? Because would you have committed perjury, you know, had you not been falsely accused?
Okay.
It brings up so many issues here. The UIGEA was basically about transferring of funds, was trying to get money laundering out of it, was trying to handle that aspect. It had nothing to do with actual online playing itself. So, what happens now if online playing is legal? It's raising a ton of questions. The indictments that came out in April now, what's going to happen with them? You still have a very, very serious one there. Again, if they falsified records, if they illegally transported money, if these other aspects of the UIGEA were violated, you know, that's still a serious problem. The argument may be made that the UIGEA should have never existed. The argument could be made that the UIGEA doesn't apply to online game or poker because it's a game of skill. There are tons of arguments that can be made there. I think this vastly weakens the case in New York and the potential for it. But it does not eliminate it.
I don't think it does either, because the indictments are all about banking. They're all about, payment processing and how it was done, and was there fraud involved by the various banking concerns, and, you know, did various people involved in online poker pay somebody off to run something so that it didn't say what it was supposed to say? I mean, that's what those indictments are about. But I keep thinking back to the guy who used to run Party Gaming, the parent company of Party Poker, Anurag
yep.
Dixit was his name. He agreed in, I think it was 2008, to plea to one count of online gambling in violation of the Federal Wire Act and agreed to forfeit $300 million to the United States. He said, I came to believe it was, in fact, illegal under U.S. law. That's what he said to the judge.
Yep.
He said, I've taken full responsibility for my actions. He was the one who initiated the process. Essentially, he voluntarily paid $300 million as Party Poker withdrew from the U.S. under UIGEA. But he said he was confessing, essentially, to violating the Wire Act. Well, now, if it turns out that he didn't violate the Wire Act because the Wire Act didn't apply, it seems to me like somebody owes this guy $300 million.
I wonder if he put a stop payment on that check.
I think it's a little bit too late. That check is long gone.
Yeah. So does he get it back plus interest?
I don't think he'll ever see it back, but it does raise the question, if the DOJ thought that the Wire Act didn't apply, why'd they take the check and why'd they accept his plea of being guilty? This is like you're pleading guilty for something that's not a crime, and they go, okay, we agree, you're guilty of a non-crime, pay us.
Yeah, I know. This just raises so many issues out there. It's the exact ruling that the PPA thought would happen if they ever got it in front of a judge, and it has now happened, and we've got to see what the ramifications are, but I think you're going to see some massive changes and some massive movements forward in the next year. Because there's just way, way, way too much money sitting out there that the states and the federal government wants in their coffers.
All right. Now, one other aspect of this that we haven't touched on, and that is the UIGEA you mentioned and how it is applied to intrastate gambling. We don't think it necessarily applies to intrastate online poker, and that's why there's a push on by the states to do this, because they think that they can do it with the feds not minding. But if
Correct.
You're going to talk about interstate and eventually you're going to get it going within the U.S., would it just be within the U.S.? Here's what I'm thinking. As you know, with your association with PokerStars, they have PokerStars France. They have PokerStars Italy. They have PokerStars Estonia. In those countries, only the people in that country can play against only other people in that specific country. France can't play Italy. France can't play the Canadians, the Mexicans, the Asians, or whatever it is. They can only play the French. Same thing within Italy, Estonia, etc. Is that what's going to happen in the United States? Will we end up with not only can you only play if you're in Nevada, but if it goes to a multi-state thing, would it not be able to leave the borders of the U.S. so you would no longer really have a global, real money, online poker environment?
It absolutely could start out that way. There's no doubt about it. I think eventually you will have a worldwide playing field. But how long it's going to take to get to that one, I don't know. And, yes, I absolutely think that they could limit it to start with to within the borders of the U.S. France, Estonia, Italy, all these others that are doing the limitations right now, I think even eventually those barriers will end up falling. But right now, everybody's concerned about their own country, concerned about their own revenue, concerned about maintaining and keeping it within their borders, and they're putting up, you know, false walls all the way around the country. The U.S. is very, very likely to do the very same thing.
Do you think it's also possible that in each of these different states, you're going to end up with different operators? So in Nevada, it might turn out to be Caesars or Wynn or whoever it is that ends up doing it in Nevada. It might just be one operator there, while, you know, Missouri might fall under either Caesars or one of the other competing casino companies. Or in Connecticut, if they were to go for it, it could be the tribe that runs Foxwoods, the Mashantucket Pequot tribe. And all over the country, you're going to have different operators of online poker. And then you have to hope that to make it interstate, you've now got to get these different operators to agree and cooperate.
Oh, you've absolutely nailed it right there. That's the reason why we've always pushed for a federal one rather than an individual state one, because you have 50 different states. Some of the states are going to opt out and not have any, and that's going to upset some people. Some of them are going to say we can only do it within our own border, and that's going to upset some people. There's going to be some states that are going to go together, just like the lottery. There's not one lottery for all 50 states. There's a variety of different lotteries, and different states belong to different ones, and you're liable to have the same damn thing. If we had a federal one, if the guys in Washington would do their job, then we could actually set this up. But as it stands right now, you are probably going to have different operators in different states. There's going to be a lot of duplicates. For all we know, Harrah's might be in every 50 states, or Caesars. But, you know, there's going to be individual ones, too. It could turn into a nightmare. It absolutely could, and it could be to the detriment of poker players because of it.
All right.
A federal law regulating, protecting, and monitoring the online poker thing is the best solution. But I don't know when or if that'll happen.
I think the states will do it first. You know, if the states want to move forward with it this year, there seems to be no interest at the federal level in an election year in Washington to do it on the federal level. But at the state level, especially where revenue is so desperately needed, I can see them pushing forward with it. It's going to take one or two states to break the dam. And then once they do, the others are going to come rushing through there.
I absolutely agree. And there's one other thing, a news thing that PokerStars did in France I would love to talk about if we've got a couple of minutes.
We do. Go ahead.
All righty. They came out. Now, you saw all of the debacle that happened after Black Friday and with Full Tilt and with the money there and whether it was misappropriated and such. What PokerStars is proposing and going to do in France and wants to do worldwide and wants to require other operators to do is to bring in a third party, an independent regulator, to handle the deposit. So, in other words, if you send $100 in to be deposited, that money then goes into an account that PokerStars doesn't monitor, doesn't handle. It's an independent third party, a bank or something like that, that handles it, so that the PokerStars cannot touch that money. That's not their money to touch, which is as it should be anyhow. It isn't. It's a deposit. But totally separating it, not giving them the option to do anything with that money.
So that there's no way that the company money and the player money can be commingled, which is the problem that Full Tilt ran
into. Correct. You eliminate it. You eliminate any chance of misappropriation, any chance of commingling, any chance of the player's money not being safe. What more could you ask for?
I like it. I like
it. I love it. When they brought that up and volunteered to do it and wanted to do it and wanted to make it the industry standard.
I hope that those who set up online poker in the U.S. follow that example, because that's one way to make sure that everything goes by the book.
There you go.
All right, we're going to take a break here in a moment, and then we'll be joined by Tristan Wade, a guy who's got a bracelet from the World Series of Poker Europe, where he won a shootout event just a couple of months ago. I promise you some news about Harrah's St. Louis. I'm sitting here in the World Series of Poker Room. I turn around. I look at the bad beat jackpot. I knew it was hit on Friday night because I was in here playing PLO about an hour after it got hit when quad queens got beaten. Quad jacks got beaten by a straight flush for about $117,000 jackpot. That was on Friday night. I did not come and play on Saturday, New Year's Eve, but the backup jackpot was about $70,000 or $75,000 and got hit again when quad eights were beaten by a queen high straight flush. So now when I turn around and look at it, the bad beat jackpot, the tertiary jackpot, is only about $15,000 right now. But it will build back up because people are coming in here and playing. There are half a dozen live games going on, plus the tournament going on here as well. And there'll be PLO at this table as soon as we finish the show here today, as there is 7 days a week. So if you're a hold'em player, whether it's No Limit or Limit or Tournament or Pot Limit Omaha, you can come in here and play. And a reminder about Big Game 2. We ran the first one at the end of October and had a couple of tables of people playing in our 25-50 game, and we had a wonderful time. The word has spread, and people have been saying, when can we do it again? Well, the answer is the end of this month. January 27th, 28th, 29th, the final weekend of January, we're going to do it again. It's a $15,000 minimum buy-in, $25.50 with a $10 ante, no limit hold'em. We hope to get the two tables that we had before, possibly more, because we do have increased interest as word spread about how great the game was. We'll also be running the concurrent 10-20 game with a $5 ante. That has a minimum buy-in of $2,500. If you are interested in coming, we can give you information about hotel room discounts here at Harrah's. We can tell you how to wire your money here. We can give you all the details you want if you'll just email us. The email address for this show is dennisphillipspoker@gmail.com. We both check that address on a regular basis. I will be coordinating the list for the Big Game 2, and if you want to get on it and get all the information, send me a note with your email address and your phone number, and I will get right back in touch with you with everything you need to know. Again, dennisphillipspoker@gmail.com. And by the way, those of you who might be flying in from somewhere else, and we did have people coming from all the states of the Midwest last time, we'd like to expand it and get people from all over the country who want to come in and play in this. We will pick you up at the airport and get you over here to Harrah's, and you'll have a wonderful time with us. The food here is good. The games here are good. The poker room here is great. So, again, Big Game 2 is January 27th, 28th, and 29th. Email dennisphillipspoker@gmail.com for more information. We'll also put it up on the blog for this show on thechipleader.com. Back with more of the final table in a moment here on 590 The Fan KFNS and KFNS.com. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show with Dennis Phillips in Las Vegas. I am Paul Harrah in the World Series of Poker Room at Harrah's St. Louis. You want to see what games are being played here right now? Download the Bravo Poker Live app, and it'll tell you what the current live games are. You can get it for the iPhone and for Android. It's Bravo Poker Live. Keep you updated on what's happening here at Harrah's St. Louis. 2011 was a pretty good year for today's guest. In March, he won the World Poker Challenge main event. In June, he final tabled the WSOP 6 Max Championship and another No Limit Hold'em event. In July, he finished second at the Florida State Poker Championship 6 Max event. And in October, he went to the WSOP Europe in Cannes, where he won his first bracelet in the 3,000 euro No Limit Hold'em shootout event and also cashed in a 6 Max event. His total tournament winnings last year, a little over $750,000. He also has 10 other WSOP caches in the previous 4 years, and he's a member of the Deep Stacks Live team of pros, which includes Mike Matisau and Michael Mizrachi and Justin Smith and Karina Jett. His name is Tristan Wade. You may know him online as Creative, and we're happy to have him on the final table today. Hi, Tristan. How are you?
Great. How you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Our pleasure. Congratulations on your year last year. Where's your bracelet? Is it safe?
Yeah, it definitely is safe. It's my first one, so I got to cherish it. It's locked away in a secure location.
You know, I'm asking because we had that horrible story a couple of weeks ago about Jonathan Duhamel, whose home was broken into and some thugs took his bracelet.
Yeah, luckily, if that ever did happen to me, they won't find a bracelet anywhere around here.
Love it. Hey, I want to jump right into this thing. You have three times in the last year on a six-match event cash. Twice, I think, you've made the final table. You seem to do very, very well on a short table, because you also did well on the shootout out there at in Cannes. What's your special? What strategy do you do? What's your major difference between a six max and a full range strategy?
Well, I think I know hand ranges very well in six max tournament play, just because I spent a lot of time on the internet before Black Friday took place, and I played a lot of six max tournaments. So I feel like I just kind of know what situations arise and what I should do in those given situations.
So for our listeners who normally would play ring games but eventually do end up in a shorthanded situation, whether it's in a cash game or in a tournament, what would you say to them is an effective strategy as a beginner at that level?
Well, you definitely have to be able to open up your hand ranges and your starting hands that you want to play. And since you're playing six-handed, you have to be able to adapt quicker. So I would say to be more aggressive than you typically would be in a nine-handed would be a basic strategy for, you know, an amateur that's trying to loosen up their game a little bit in a six-max.
So in addition to the hand range, does that mean more three-betting?
Yeah, definitely. Once you get a shorter stack, like 15 to 20 big blinds, maybe even 25 big blinds, you definitely should be looking to three-bet, maybe even just three-bet jam on opponents that are raising a lot with a wider range, especially if you have a good image and they won't call you too light.
So a lot of it is the same strategy you would have in a pool game. You're taking advantage of your table image and what you can get away with, and you're trying to put them on a range of hands. But is it more or less just you getting more aggressive, opening up more, three-betting more, getting a little more action? Is that what you're doing more in six-max?
Well, I think more in six-max, it just kind of, you know, well, some of the tournaments I played, you know, for example, the 10K six-max at the WSOP, the structure was really good. So when you're playing in tournaments that have really good structures, you can kind of be a little more patient, whereas in six-max, some people are just taking their aggression level to the top, where I might sit back a little bit and just let them do what they're trying to do. You know, so I sometimes play a little more patient strategy. But, yeah, you do have to follow the same kind of rules with the hand ranges and things like that. But three-betting and picking your spots is a lot more easier to do at a six-max table, I feel like, than a nine-handed table.
So you find once you've been playing as much six-max as you have been that when you then sit down in a full ring game, you actually have to say to yourself, change gears.
Yeah, oh, without a doubt. I mean, six-max and nine-handed and, you know, even nine-handed and eight-handed and seven-handed, they're all so different, and they have their little complexities that you really need to be able to adjust to. And that's probably one of the biggest things with people that, you know, aren't really familiar with the difference in, you know, players at the table. They probably don't have the best grasp of that. So once they do jump from nine-handed to six-handed, there really is a big difference.
Dennis, this reminds me of what you told me about 3 years ago when you were going off to the WSOP, which is you needed to get some final table experience, not a nine-handed table or an eight-handed table, but what do you do when you get down to seven, six, five, four, eventually hoping to get to the final three as you did, because you do have to play it differently.
And it's so much harder to get that experience, because if you're sitting in a cash game and it's a full ring and it's a popular one, you know, there's very seldom you're playing less. And you're in a tournament, you know, until you get down to the final table, you may play one or two players short, but that's the most. You don't get the experience playing four-handed and five-handed and six-handed unless you do something like this six-max. It is much more difficult to get it.
And Dennis is absolutely right, because even if you play short-handed in the cash game with, you know, six or seven people or even four or five people, it's still not the same as a tournament because
Correct.
The tournament strategy and cash game strategy is just completely different. So, like Dennis said, it is hard to get that experience unless you do play a lot of tournaments and a lot of shorthanded play with variating stack sizes.
While we're given some instructional information here, and I know you do that as one of the Deep Stacks Live's instructors going out on the road and doing seminars all over the place, let's talk a little bit about bet sizing, which has been a topic that we touched on a lot last year on the show. And a recurring theme from some of the other pros we've talked to is you see bet sizing changing over the course of the last year or two, and you still see a lot of amateurs who don't understand that they don't need to put as much of their stack at risk, even when they're just three betting somebody pre-flop or opening for a raise pre-flop.
Yeah, bet sizing is one of those things that I think it kind of goes through stages. It evolves in a sense, and I think you're kind of going to see bet sizing maybe loop back to how it used to be a couple years ago in some ways, but yeah, people just have to understand, you know, bet sizing all depends on who's in the pot with you, how many players you're facing, what kind of board texture there is. You know, it's not just I have, you know, aces and I need to bet the pot. You know, there's a lot more to bet sizing and to controlling a pot and manipulating your opponents than just the amount you're betting.
Well, I actually, in the last few tournaments I've played, I've seen almost the reverse for it, and I'm starting to like it. I'm starting to see how I can incorporate that into my game. I see people on a 100, 200 level betting 1,100 for an opening bet.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, you're looking at them going, all right, is this some amateur who doesn't know what the heck he's doing? Or is this guy, it starts to question. I can see a place where you do a 5, a 6, or a 7 times the blind type of opening bet. I can see hands to do that. I'm going to experiment with that a little bit, to be truthful. What do you think of it?
Yeah, I think it's actually, I think you're on the right, you know, kind of track, because I also do get that kind of sense that there might be a time where it is good to make a 4 or 5X raise, or, you know, even throw an overbet of the pot, or, you know, things like that. There are definitely times where I think you could put people in tough spots when you do change your bet sizing in drastic ways that they, especially if they don't expect it. And, you know, I think, you know, someone like Dennis would get a lot of value at doing something that would just throw everybody, you know, off the board, that they wouldn't understand, you know, oh, my God, he played so good up to now. What's he doing the 7X raise for? You know, it might confuse them a little bit.
Or a situation where you're playing a small 2-5 game and there's 40 in the pot, and the guy who is first to act, who wasn't the pre-flop raiser, the flop comes out and he bets 110. What does that mean now? It doesn't mean what it used to mean.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing. That's the best thing about poker. You know, it's always going to evolve. You're going to have people that, you know, it's just a logical game and everyone can experiment with things. And I think that's what the problem with poker is now. You know, everyone feels like there's a certain way to play and that you have to stay in this kind of scope of how you're going to play. Well, I don't agree with that. You know, I think poker is just a people's game. You can play it however you want to play it. I don't ever get upset or mad at anybody. You do what you want to do. You play how you want to play. And, you know, if you experiment and you try to do things that are different, I think it's beneficial more than it will ever hurt you.
Oh, I love it. When you do something and you look across the table and this weird look coming back from the player you did it against, he doesn't know what the heck you did, or he's perplexed, or it's like, what the heck? And God, that just, no, I love that.
But you know what? We've all been in that situation where you look across, you know, it could be a complete amateur or it could be a pro, and you look across, would you really have done that with three queens? And you got to run through the range of hands that he would have done that particular hand with, and sometimes it's so bizarre you can't figure it out. And now you have to say to yourself, the story doesn't add up. Normally when the story doesn't add up, I have to make the call. But sometimes the story doesn't add up because I have no idea what's happening here, and you got to make that lay down, right?
Yeah, there's been a few situations when I've gotten in a pot like that against an amateur, and it looked like they might know what they're doing with, you know, some kind of absurd bet. And then when you actually do calm down, because like you said, the story didn't make sense, you're like, oh, of course he had the nuts. You know, he's an amateur. He's not going to take it to that other level. But whereas you might play against some pros, and they might just throw you through a loop in that kind of sense, too.
I just, again, a hand that I played here this last weekend, I raised preflop with a 9-6 of hearts in early position, and the flop came down a 5-7-8. So I immediately made a pot-sized bet, and I got two callers.
Mm-hmm.
It was awesome. I loved it.
Instead of slow playing it, I mean, we've talked in the past about how, you know, you smash the flop. Don't slow play it in that situation. You want these people to have something and play back at you.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I almost wanted to show my cards, but I didn't. They ended up, nobody called me by the time it got to the river, so I had to just muck my cards. I so much wanted to show everybody the sand.
Yeah, I don't know how Dennis has been playing as of late. I know how he played. You know, I did watch a lot of the coverage from the main event a few years back when you got third place. Congratulations by that on the wave. And, you know, I don't know if people kind of give you credit for, you know, being a more solid player, or if they would, you know, expect you to raise 9-6 suited in early position. So maybe, you know, that maybe would have helped your image a little if you did get to show it.
I thought about it. I really wanted to, but I ended up mucking it.
Yeah, probably a smart decision. I'm on the same boat as you. I don't like showing my hands. I don't like giving away free information if it doesn't need to be done.
Yeah, I'm the same way. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show. Dennis Phillips in Las Vegas. I'm Paul Harris here in St. Louis. Our guest is Tristan Wade, one of the Deep Stacks pros who is from Florida. You still living in Florida, by the way?
Yeah, I'm still in South Florida currently. I'm here for a while, unless I decide to move somewhere for a few months to play online poker or something like that.
Well, I was going to ask you, I actually have two questions related to that. One, what's the Florida poker situation like? We know it changed a year and a half ago when they finally raised the limits and you could play real poker, and a lot of pros from around the country said, ooh, I'm going to move there. How is it now as a pro? And the other part of that is, are you thinking of leaving the U.S. because Black Friday killed your online business?
The first part of poker in Florida is good. I mean, I think people kind of blow it up to be much better than it is. It is really good. We do have a lot of great casinos around the area. I'm in South Florida, and we got a lot of really good casinos down here. But there's a lot of good players in the games, too. You know, don't get me wrong. You can find good games at some casinos.
I guess we just lost Tristan there. I'm asking about Florida because I'm thinking about going down there in February for the circuit event at the Palm Beach Kennel Club. I played there last year and didn't cash in the tournament I played, but I loved the live action there. You've yet to go down to Florida, have you, Dennis?
I really haven't had time to. I've been a ton of other places. And when I go down to the PCA here in a few days, won't get out of the Miami airport, I'm afraid. It's not going to work this time either. So,
hey, sorry, I got disconnected, I guess.
Oh, that's okay. I'm glad we got you back.
No problem.
So the second part of the question was, you were a big online player. People knew you as Creativ, the number 8 in the middle there, online. Since Black Friday, you know, the online poker pro business has gone downhill considerably. Are you thinking of leaving the U.S. to play?
Yeah, I definitely have some thoughts of you know, heading out of the U.S., maybe to Canada or some other nice country for a few months just to play online poker again. I miss, you know, having the freedom to just fire up some tables and play again. But luckily I've had a good year in 2011, so I didn't have to rush that decision to go play online somewhere.
Yeah, $750,000, I count that as a good year.
Yes, definitely. No complaints here.
I assume you're going over to the PCA here in a few days?
I'm not sure. I think I'm just going to go for the main event. I haven't decided, but it is only a 30-minute flight. It's kind of in my backyard, so it'd be kind of crazy to miss the main event over there.
Oh, I thought maybe, because they've got a couple of unique ones. Over in Europe, remember how they went from a full table down to a heads-up with the different structure they had there. They've got a couple of unique ones over there at the PC. By the way, did you play that one? What did you think of the one that the Grinder won over there?
I actually didn't get to play that one because one of the other tournaments I was still in, and day two was going on.
Oh, darn.
Yeah, I would have enjoyed to play that, though. It seemed like a very good structure for the tournament, and a lot of my friends who played it had a really good time playing it.
Was that your first time in Europe, Tristan?
Yes, it was. I had an unbelievable time. I mean, it's just such an amazing country.
Did you go to both the EPT in London and the WSOPE in Cannes?
Yes, Yes, I did. I started off in London, like you said. Saw a couple other countries along the way, and then went to Cannes, and went home after Cannes.
So your first trip to Europe, you visited several different countries. You got to play poker over there, and you brought home more money than you left with.
Yes.
Was it a good vacation?
Yes, it was. It was a great vacation. That's even an understatement. It still hasn't even hit me yet that I won a bracelet yet.
Tristan, how do European players compare to American players?
You could definitely tell a difference. I think the European players are more aggressive, and I do think that they just play more hands and play more pots, and they just play them more aggressively. You know, it's definitely a good change. It was a nice pace of change to go over there and, you know, get a little more action from amateur players.
Did you notice any difference between the different type, like Scandinavian players versus English players versus something that way, or was it just in general?
No, I did. I wasn't sure of where everyone was from, the origin of everybody, but some of the players I did play with, like some of the French players and, you know, European players and things like that, you could definitely get a sense for the different types of regions where they're located. I did a radio show with the French people over there, and they were talking about how the French hardly cash in any events and how bad the French players were. And these were French players talking about their own players. And you did get to kind of see that the French are very inexperienced with poker, and they're just learning, and they play so differently. So, yeah, Dennis, I did get to see exactly what you're talking about with different, you know, regions playing differently, differently.
But we definitely know that Europeans can play. Look at the final two of the main event this year at the WSOP. You had Pius Hines and Martin Staszko, German and a Czech, playing heads up after knocking Ben Lamb out in third place. We can't call this the American game anymore, can we?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, it's such a worldwide game, and you know, America's really getting hurt now without the legislation and, regulation of poker. I mean, we're getting placed back. You know, we're not able to play on the Internet anymore and get our mileage back up there and our experience back up there. So these guys in Europe and other parts of the world, they're going to catch up with us and, you know, maybe even surpass us in poker. I mean, America's not at the forefront anymore.
Well, this has been a great talk. We've got to have you back on again because we didn't get to half the things we were going to talk about. But I want to give you time. We've only got a couple of minutes left. I want to give you time to talk about Deep Stack and what's coming up new there before this is over.
Okay, yeah. Well, the first Deep Stack's Poker Tour event that we got, it's a series in Seneca, New York. It's coming up February 14th. We have our televised main event. It's going to be televised regionally in upstate New York. And, I'm looking forward to being part of the show. I'm one of the commentators. I'm an analyst on the show.
You're doing that with Stapes?
Yeah, with Joe Stapleton.
Cool.
Yeah, so we're going to have, you know, I'm sure we'll have other people on the show like Grinder and Mattiso, but, you know, we'll all be up there in Seneca the middle of February having a good time playing some poker, and then we're going to announce some of the future tour dates for the Deep Stack Poker Tour. Probably in the next few weeks.
Now, what I like about this is that the main event is a $1,500 buy-in. That seems to be just the right price point, $1,500, $1,600 for main events in order to get big fields. And I hope you guys can get that as well on this first event and then in whatever other events you're going to announce for the rest of the year.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, you know, we're really trying to keep the buy-ins low, you know, keep them in moderate so everyone can play them. And then, you know, we're also bringing in pros so people can have just a great experience, like playing a big tournament, but for a smaller, you know, smaller buy-in.
All right, for more information, you can go online to deepstackspokertour.com. Tristan Wade, thanks so much for joining us today at the final table.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks, Dennis. I had a great time. I appreciate it. Have me back anytime.
All right. Have a great 2012. And, Dennis, I know you're headed off to the PCA in just the next couple of days. We'll have you broadcasting live from there next week, right?
That's exactly right. We'll see what kind of turnout. The last I saw, they were worried about it being affected by Black Friday. It doesn't appear to have bothered it that much. They had over 600 qualifiers the last I knew. They're going to add to that number, obviously. They may not equal the 1,130 they had last year, but it's going to be a 1,130 qualifiers and 1,600 in the main event. But I'm telling you, it's going to be over 1,000 people. It might be 12 or 1,300 in their main event.
Well, great.
It's going to be good.
Good luck to you, and I'll talk to you next week.
All right, take care.
He's Dennis Phillips. I'm Paul Harris. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show, live every Tuesday at 3 on 590 of the Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com. And on demand anytime, our podcasts on iTunes and thechipleader.com.